Unsolved, Unbelievable, and Unjust, a podcast where we dive into the most chilling of all cold cases and take a look at crimes with facts that are so crazy that they are, well, unbelievable. And lastly, we examine instances where the justice system has terribly failed us. I'm Ashley, your host, and thanks for tuning in. Hello, true crime lovers, and welcome back to another episode of Unsolved, Unbelievable, and Unjust. I wanted to start off this week by saying thank you so much for all of the positive responses that I got to my last week's episode. I really appreciate that all so much. This week, we are going to be looking at the Long Island serial killer case. We're going to be back to a regular length episode this week. And for those of you who are familiar with this case, you know that it is about to be a wild ride. This is a twisty and turny and unexpected ending case, and I'm ready to jump on into it. So let's do that right now. So the Long Island serial killer case starts out in New Jersey. I bet you thought I was going to say Long Island. So our story starts with a young woman named Shannon Gilbert. She lived in New Jersey, like I said, and she had dreams of becoming a singer. Her family reports that she was extremely smart, even graduating from high school a year early, and that she was very involved with her family. While living in New Jersey, Shannon became a prostitute in order to earn money. She would work at night, and then she would go on singing auditions during the day. When her family found out about her newfound career, they were embarrassed. However, Shannon told them that it was only temporary while she was trying to find a job as a singer, and she maintained a close relationship with her family despite their opinions about her job choice. Shannon also had a boyfriend named Alex Diaz. Shannon and Alex lived together and ran an escort business together. However, the business did get shut down by the police, after which the couple started fighting a lot. One of their fights turned physical and actually ended with Shannon in the hospital needing surgery to have a metal plate put in her jaw because Alex had punched her so hard that he had actually broken it. Unfortunately, Shannon decided to stay with Alex after this incident. Once she had recovered from her surgery, she started advertising on Craigslist to make some extra money as the couple was now broke due to their business being shut down and due to all of the medical bills that come along with going to the hospital when you live in the States. When Shannon was going to jobs that she had obtained through Craigslist, she would never go to these meetups alone. Thank goodness. Nobody should ever do that. If you are working in that industry, girls, please take someone along with you. She always had a driver come with her, and it was either Alex, her boyfriend, or a friend named Michael Pack. On May 10th, 2010, Shannon got a job in Oak Beach, Long Island, which was about an hour's drive away from New Jersey. Shannon was promised that she would get 5 hours pay for this job, including for her time driving there and back and for her services. Oak Beach is a very isolated area. It's known to be a bit of a party scene because it has a reputation for not really being patrolled heavily by the police. Michael Pack was her driver that night, and they pulled up to the gated house owned by Joe Brewer, who was the man who had requested Shannon's company that evening, around midnight. Shannon went inside the house, and Michael waited outside in the car like usual. However, Michael fell asleep while waiting for her, and was woken up between 4 and 5 a.m. by Joe Brewer, who was knocking on his door and asking for his help, making Shannon leave his house. He was claiming that he had asked her and she would not leave on her own. So Michael, confused as heck, goes inside to get Shannon, and he found her hiding behind the couch and totally freaking out. She was obviously scared out of her mind. Joe Brewer would later claim that he had no idea why she became, quote, unhinged. From behind the couch, Michael and Joe Brewer heard Shannon call 911 and tell the operator, quote, they are trying to kill me. Joe Brewer is like, WTF, no one's trying to kill you. So he goes behind the couch and tries to pull Shannon out to make her leave. When he does this, Shannon screams and bolts out of the house and starts running down the street. Michael Pack follows her out of the house, sees that she's running down the street, and immediately gets pissed off that she did not just run to the car so that they could leave together, which is understandable being that it's like 5 o'clock in the morning here. Michael starts following Shannon in his car down the street. And at this point, Shannon is running down the street, banging on doors left, right, and center, trying to be let in and begging people to open their door for her. All this while, she is still on the phone with 911, and that 911 call would last 23 minutes in total. Shannon told the operator that she was somewhere near Jones Beach. Unfortunately, she was mistaken and she actually was not near Jones Beach, and this did throw off the investigation a little bit. The operator reports that the phone call cut out mid-conversation. Finally, a man named Gus Coletti answers the door and asks Shannon what's wrong. At this point, she sees the spotlights of the car that Michael's driving, gets freaked out, and takes off again. And this was the last time that Shannon was seen alive. Eventually, Michael Pack gives up trying to find Shannon and drives back to New York, assuming that she would find her own way home. The next morning, Shannon's boyfriend, Alex, calls Michael to ask where Shannon is and tells Michael that she never came home the night before. Then Michael explained what happened and her erratic behavior the night before. After that, Alex called Shannon's sister to see if she had heard from Shannon, but she had not heard from her in over a month. Right after Shannon's sister gets off the phone with Alex, she gets a phone call from Michael Pack. Michael Pack tells her that he hopes Shannon is okay, and Shannon's sister is like, well, you should have fucking waited for her and driven her home like you were supposed to. When she said that, Michael said that he has nothing to hide and that he has an alibi, which is super sketchy because at this point, they don't actually know that anything has happened or that he has anything he needs an alibi for. So she obviously thought that this was weird, and she called the police immediately after they got off the phone and told them exactly what he had said. Fast forward to the next day, and Shannon's mom got a phone call from Dr. Peter Hackett. Dr. Hackett told her that he ran a home for, quote, wayward girls, and that he had Shannon there and had given her some medication to calm her down because he was worried about her. Shannon's mom was really confused at this point, and Dr. Hackett said that Shannon had given him her phone number, and that's when Shannon's mom immediately knew that Dr. Hackett was full of shit because she knew that Shannon would never have given her phone number to this doctor. She called the police as well to tell them about the phone call. That Sunday was Mother's Day, and Shannon's family went to Oak Beach to look for her. Now, Peter Hackett lives in Oak Beach, and Shannon's family literally just walked right on up to his house and confronted him about the phone call, which is a badass move, and props to you guys. When they did that, though, he completely denied ever making the phone call. Early on in the investigation, the police got a warrant to search Joe Brewer's house, and they also took him in for questioning. Joe Brewer's story was basically that he had no idea why Shannon got so spooked in the first place and ended up calling 911 saying that they're going to kill me. Nothing was discovered during the search, and he and Michael Pack were both given lie detector tests, which they both passed. Michael Pack told the police during his interview that after Shannon ran off, he drove around Ocean Parkway, which is the main highway in the area, and could not find her, so he drove back to Manhattan and assumed that she would find her own way home, which is just not a cool move. Like, your whole purpose of being there is to drive her to and from and ensure that she gets home safe, and you totally failed her, man. He also said that while he was outside in his car waiting for Shannon, he saw her and Brewer get in his car and leave for about 15 minutes before coming back. Joe Brewer would not tell the investigators where they went during this 15-minute drive. But Michael Pack told the investigators that he wouldn't be surprised if they had gone to pick up drugs, as Shannon was known to do cocaine if a client was offering, and sometimes she would even do ecstasy for her own pleasure, I guess. Alex Diaz was also interviewed by the police, and Michael Pack and Alex Diaz both told the investigators that Shannon had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and that she was known to have erratic and unpredictable behavior. This and the potential drugs could play a factor into why Shannon was acting so frantic that night. Fast forward to December 11th, 2010. While out looking for Shannon in a weedy area off of the highway that runs between Jones Beach and Robert Moses State Park, a shocking discovery was made. Four bodies were found between Oak Beach and Gilgo Beach, which is 45 miles east of New York City. Each of the bodies was found wrapped in burlap sacks. The first body to be found was that of Melissa Bartholomew, who was 24 years old and from Bronx, New York. 2 days later, during a search of the same area, the bodies of Maureen Brainard Barnes, who was 25 years old and from Norwich, Connecticut, the body of Amberlyn Costello, who was 27 and from Long Island, and the body of Megan Waterman, who was 22 years old and from Maine, were all discovered in the same manner, wrapped in burlap sacks. It was clear to the investigators that all of the bodies were related, as they had been disposed of in the same way, and they were only found about 500 feet apart from each other. Maureen Brainard Barnes was the first of the four victims to disappear in July 2007. She was last seen checking out of a Super 8 motel in New York City. Melissa Bartholomew was the second to go missing. She was last seen walking away from her apartment in the Bronx in 2009. Megan Waterman was next. She was last seen leaving a Holiday Inn Express where she was staying with her boyfriend at the time. And she was last seen leaving there around 1:30 a.m. on June 5th, 2010, after placing an ad on Craigslist earlier that night. Just a few months later, on September 2nd, 2010, Amber Costello was last seen. She was last seen leaving her home in Long Island after negotiating a $1,500 date over Craigslist. All four of these women are believed to have died from strangulation. Now, Shannon's body was obviously not among the remains found. However, all four of these women were also prostitutes who advertised on Craigslist. So the police thought that maybe Shannon's death was connected to these. Melissa Bartholomew's sister had received taunting phone calls after she went missing in 2007, and the phone calls are believed to have come from the killer. However, the phone calls were all under 3 minutes in length, and they therefore are extremely hard for the police to track. On the last phone call that she received, the caller claimed that he had killed her sister and then hung up. Now, the killer is suspected to have knowledge of police procedure, which we will get into in lots of detail later, but this is why it's expected that all of the phone calls were under 3 minutes, as it was likely that he knew the 3 minute mark is where the police can start tracking a phone call. The police had to suspend their search of the beaches over the winter due to the snow. When they resumed their search in the spring, Jessica Taylor's body was found in March, also located near Gilgo Beach. However, only her head, legs, and hands were discovered. Remarkably, her torso had actually been discovered 8 years earlier in Manorville, New York, which is an hour away. Now, make sure you remember this fact because it's going to come up later in the case. Jessica Taylor was also a prostitute. She was the last of the victims found to be identified. And spoiler alert, we are not done with finding all of the victims yet. So after discovering the previous five bodies in Suffolk County, the police decided to expand their search into the neighboring Nassau County. On April 11th, 2011, Suffolk County Police Department used a fire truck to get an aerial view over the thicket that stretches the highway that stretches along the highway leading to Jones Beach. There were also officers on foot searching with police dogs and on horseback searching the surrounding areas of Toby Beach, Jones Beach State Park, a nearby wildlife preserve, and a nearby 30-acre pond. While using the fire truck to get a view over the brush, three more bodies were discovered. Now, these victims' bodies were far older than the 5 previous bodies that had been discovered in Gilgo Beach. These victims are thought by some to be possible victims of Joel Rifkin, who was a serial killer that confessed to killing 17 prostitutes in 1993 and is currently serving a life sentence in New York. Although he confessed to 17 murders, he was only convicted of 9. Of those 9 murders that he was convicted of, 3 of the victims' bodies had never been discovered. So it's suspected that some of the remains that were found on April 11th could be related to his 3 victims whose bodies were never found. The bodies found on April 11th belonged to an unidentified woman, a 2-year-old girl, and an unidentified young Asian man who was found dressed in women's clothes, which normally is not an important detail that I wouldn't have even included, but because all of the other victims were female, I thought it was important to include because it could have led to his victimization. 1 week later, 2 more bodies were found, making a total of 10 victims found in the search for Shannon Gilbert. One of these 2 new victims included the 2-year-old's mother, but only her skull was found. Her legs had actually been found on Fire Island in 1996. All of the bodies discovered while looking for Shannon were very close together, some of them less than 0.5 mile apart. Law enforcement had to determine whether the new remains were related to the previous 4 remains that had been found in December. A year after Shannon's mom told the police about the phone call she received from Peter Hackett, the police were finally able to get phone records to prove that he had in fact called her, despite his denying it after the fact. When they questioned Peter about it, he was like, "Oh yeah, I was just kidding when I said I didn't call her. I did call her, but it was only to comfort her." However, after this, the police, for some reason, still don't think that he was involved in Shannon's disappearance. Like, come on. Nobody fucking calls the parents of a missing girl to be like, "Oh yeah, I have your daughter," if they're not involved somehow. It doesn't happen. In December 2011, the police decided to do one final search for Shannon Gilbert. This time they went deep into the marsh with some kind of machine that allowed them to go deeper than they would have been able to go on foot. On the first day of the house, they found a purse, a pair of earrings, and a pair of jeans. Guess where they found them? Right in front of Peter Hackett's house. 2 days later, they unfortunately found Shannon Gilbert's body, also right in front of Peter Hackett's house. So Shannon's family is convinced that Peter Hackett killed Shannon and threw her into the marsh so that no one would find her body. However, the police think that she ran into the marsh because she was obviously freaked out. She thought someone was chasing her. And when she did, she was overcome by the elements and she passed away naturally. In fact, before the examination of Shannon's body had even been finished, Richard Dormer, Suffolk County Police Department commissioner at the time, told the media that Shannon's death was an accident. This preemptive conclusion pissed Shannon's family off, and rightfully so. Finally, her death was ruled inconclusive by the medical examiner. In 2016, Shannon's family hired a pathologist, former chief medical examiner of New York City, Dr. Michael Baden, to do an autopsy, and he said that it's possible that Shannon could have died from strangulation. However, given that it was many years after Shannon had died that he was looking at her body, he could not make a definite conclusion. The reason he said that it was possible that Shannon could have died from strangulation is based on the condition of her hyoid bone, which is a bone in the neck that's often broken during manual strangulation, and in Shannon's case, it had been broken. And this would not have happened during an accidental drowning, as the police were currently suggesting. Also, when Shannon's body was discovered, she was not wearing any clothes, and her clothes were actually found several hundred feet away from her. So the police's theory that she was running into the marsh out of fear and fell down and tripped and accidentally drowned makes absolutely no sense, because anyone running for their life isn't going to be like, "Oh yeah, you know what's going to make running through this thick ass marsh easier? Getting fucking naked." I really don't know how the police can possibly think that this is a rational theory at this point. So the police assume that a serial killer is to blame for some, if not all, of the deaths of the victims that were found while searching for Shannon. However, the police don't think that Shannon's death was related, as first of all, they think it's a fucking accident. And second of all, her death does not match the pattern of the victims at Gilgo Beach, given that they were all found so close together, wrapped in burlap sacks, and they were all buried. Now, there's a lot of debate among investigators and people involved in this case about how many suspects are to blame for those 10 deaths. And those 10, keep in mind, do not include Shannon Gilbert. Some involved in the investigation believe that there was only one male suspect responsible, and it's believed that it's a male due to the phone calls received by Melissa Bartholomew's sister. However, others involved in the investigation believe that there could be up to 3 different suspects, and this honestly seems, unfortunately, the more likely scenario because of A, the original bodies were all found disposed of in the same way, and anyone who studies serial killers knows that they're really unlikely to change their MO. They are creatures of habit, and they're not going to stray from like disposing of bodies wrapped in burlap sacks to just disposing of them randomly. It's also believed that whoever committed the murders was very familiar with the Gilgo Beach area and possibly grew up there. Like I said before, law enforcement officials even speculated that the serial killer could be an ex-cop or other former law enforcement officer because it seemed very likely that the killer was familiar with police procedure and used that to his advantage to hide the bodies well. Now, the bodies were hidden in what could be considered a perfect place to hide a body. They were along a quiet beach on an island with low police present and obscured by thick bramble. For those of you who don't know what bramble is, I had to Google it as well. It's a prickly shrub of the rose family. The area they found the bodies in was described by Chief Cameron, who was the commanding officer of the Special Patrol Bureau at the time the 4 bodies were discovered in Gilgo Beach. He described the conditions of the discovery site as follows. It's brambles, briars that rip and tear at your clothes and your skin. There's very, very dense poison ivy. There's ticks. In fact, the vegetation was so thick where the bodies were found that if someone was standing 2 feet into the brush, you would not be able to see them from where you were. The investigators also thought that separating the mother and the baby's burial grounds was an intentional act to throw off investigators. Joshua Zeman, who researched the case for 4 years for an A&E series called The Killing Season, stated, "The killer was trying to confuse law enforcement and the medical examiners because he knew they would have to be investigated by separate counties." 2 victims were found with their body parts separated and buried over an hour's part away from each other. And this is another tactic that investigators believe was used by the killer to throw off the investigation. He also chose only or mostly sex workers as his victims, depending on how many victims different investigators attribute to him. And it's suspected that he chose his victims because he knew that sex workers' movements are typically harder to track, given that they tend to hide their profession from their family and friends, lie about their whereabouts to cover it up, use burner phones, and things like that. Joshua Zeman from A&E also stated that these killers are using the inadequacies of the law enforcement against them. So basically, it sounds like this guy is going to be really freaking hard to catch. In 2012, Shannon's family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Peter Hackett, claiming that he negligently administered medical care that caused her death. This is due to the phone call where he said he ran home for wayward girls and claimed that he gave Shannon medication to calm her down. Unfortunately, in 2013, a large portion of the case was dismissed by the judge, including all counts of wrongful death. However, some portions of the case were allowed to proceed. Now, I'm not sure the outcome of this case because in 2016, Sarah Gilbert, who is Shannon's younger sister, stabbed her mother Marie to death, as if the family had not gone through enough already. Sarah was diagnosed with schizophrenia prior to this and had been in the hospital 10 times in the 3 years preceding her mother's murder. 2 months before she murdered Marie, Sarah was indicted on charges of child endangerment and animal cruelty for slaying a pit bull. I hate anyone who does anything to dogs or any animals. So fuck you, Sarah. She was later convicted for her mother's murder by a jury who did not believe her insanity defense. Now, randomly, years after the bodies were discovered, the police released a photo of a belt to the public, and the belt had the initials HM or WH, depending on which way you're holding it. The police gave very little explanation for this belt, why they had decided to release it at that time, and they only said that they believed the killer had handled it. They didn't give any information on whether they thought that those were the killer's initials or whatever. To this day, no suspects have been apprehended for these murders. And there are a few theories about why this is. Some people say that the early stages of the investigation were compromised by investigators in leadership positions who were later charged with mishandling other cases. Others say it was due to the fact that the commissioner who was in charge of running the investigation changed a year after the first four bodies were found, and this led to a lapse in the investigation. According to Commissioner Burke, who was the one to take over the case a year in, said that there was, quote, no transition within the police department. He never sat down with me and talked to me. It was probably the biggest homicide investigation in Suffolk County history. We were right in the middle of this. Former commissioners Verone and Dormer said that the FBI was very involved in the case when they had been working on it. However, a year after Commissioner Burke was involved in the case, he and the district attorney, Thomas Sopta, declined an offer from the FBI to put together a profile on the Long Island serial killer. Now, why did they deny this? Well, we're about to find out. Now, Commissioner Burke is no stranger to trouble himself and has been subject to an internal investigation in the past for having a romantic relationship with a convicted prostitute and drug offender. The investigation showed that during the course of their relationship, she had access to his police cruiser and weapon. While he was apparently passed up for a promotion because of this, he was not formally disciplined in any way. In case you hadn't already guessed it, Commissioner Burke was the one charged with mishandling evidence in another case and believed to have compromised this investigation as well. In February 2016, Commissioner Burke pleaded guilty to charges of assaulting and threatening a suspect named Christopher Loeb. Christopher Loeb had been taken into custody without a lawyer after he stole a duffel bag out of Burke's unlocked car on December 14, 2012. The duffel bag that was stolen is believed to have contained porn and sex toys that belonged to the officer. According to the charges, he not only assaulted the victim, but conspired with and intimidated/threatened other law enforcement officers to cover up the assault. In 2015, an anonymous FBI source told the New York Post that Commissioner Burke did not want the FBI involved in the Long Island serial killer investigation because he knew that the FBI was investigating him. However, although Christopher Loeb was arrested and assaulted by Commissioner Burke in 2012, the FBI investigation into Burke's misconduct did not actually start until 2013. So when Commissioner Burke and District Attorney Thomas Sopta refused the FBI's request for help, he was not actively under investigation at that time. However, according to a memo written by two Suffolk County Police Department officers, the District Attorney Thomas Sopta called the FBI to decline their request for help right around the time that Christopher Loeb was arrested. So it seems a little fishy that, you know, an officer goes around assaulting people and then randomly they deny the FBI's help into a major investigation like days later. In yet another plot twist, District Attorney Thomas Sopta is also facing a federal investigation of his own for allegations that his office illegally tracked and strong-armed political adversaries into compliance. The DA's office has been called, quote, a criminal enterprise, and the allegations against the office have been described as shocking. Commissioner Sini, who took over the investigation after Commissioner Burke was indicted, brought the FBI back in to the case in 2015, and he also assigned two detectives to work on the case full-time. In 2015, the FBI finally completed the killer profile that Burke and Sopta had declined years earlier. Commissioner Sini was careful not to be too critical of anyone involved in the investigation before him, but he did say, quote, certain high-level decisions that I certainly would not have made, and later said that not fully engaging with the FBI throughout the case was one of those decisions. And, like, who the fuck turns down the FBI? They're the FBI. Like, they know a lot more shit than your local police department does. Like, let them freaking help. It's no wonder that this case is still unsolved. Now, all of these reasons why the Long Island serial killer case has been completely bungled could also contribute to why Shannon's case has never been solved either, or why it's been being treated like an accident, which it obviously wasn't. And like I said earlier, nobody running through the woods for their life is taking their clothes off before they keep running. It just doesn't make any fucking sense. Police have also been criticized for the disproportionate amount of attention that Shannon's disappearance received compared to the other victims. Now, not to play devil's advocate here, because I am not denying that the police completely fucked up this case. But compared to the other female victims who were found, Shannon was far more open about her whereabouts than the other girls. The other girls had not told their friends or family where they were on the day of their disappearance, and Shannon did. So the police had a better starting point, to say the least, in Shannon's case. She was also the only victim known to have made a 911 call, and none of the other girls' families knew where they were on the disappearance, so they really weren't able to give the police any leads to go off of. Others believe that the case would have been handled better if the victims had not been prostitutes. These include Robert Kochler, who's the author of Lost Girls, which is a book released in 2013 about the Long Island serial killer case. And this book is also the basis of the mystery film Lost Girls that came out in 2020. Kochler stated, "It's clear to me that if these victims came from different social strata, the police would have worked harder and faster." Now, even though no one has been arrested for these murders, there is someone who's suspected of these killings. And that person is John Bitrolf. John Bitrolf was convicted of the murders of Rita Tangredi and Colleen McNamee. I'm sorry, girls, I butchered those names. He's also suspected of killing a third woman named Sandra Costilla, but he was never charged in relation to this. Rita and Colleen's bodies were found naked and 14 kilometers apart from each other in 1993 and 1994, respectively. Both women had been strangled and suffered severe head trauma. However, the crimes would go unsolved for two decades before Bitrolf was caught. Now, keep in mind that these bodies were found just 34 miles away from where the bodies were discovered at Gilgo Beach. On September 12, 2017, he was sentenced to two consecutive life sentences. Before he was convicted, he worked as a carpenter and lived in Manorville, New York. Now, remember that this is where Jessica Taylor's torso was found in 2003. John Bitrolf is reported to once have, quote, cut out the heart of a deer he had just shot and ate it raw in the woods. Ew. He's also reported to have once wrestled a pig to the ground and slit its throat. He's described by many to have hated women and all living creatures. So he sounds like a real treat. John Bitroff was caught for the murders when his brother, Timothy Bitroff, had to submit DNA for violating a protection order that was completely unrelated to this case. The DNA was a partial match to the semen found on Colleen and Rita's bodies. When Timothy was eliminated as a suspect, the police obtained John Bitroff's DNA from garbage outside of his house and arrested him. Something to keep in mind is that Rita and Colleen also worked as sex workers, and that all three bodies of Rita, Colleen, and Sandra were discovered not too far from Gilgo Beach. Suffolk County District Attorney's Office Prosecutor Robert Biancaville released a statement wherein he said, quote, "There are remains from the victims at Gilgo Beach that may be attributed to the handiwork of Mr. Bitroff, and that investigation continues. Besides the location and choice of the victims that ties him to the Long Island serial killer case, there is one other major connection. Rena Tangredi, one of the murders that he was convicted of, her daughter was best friends with Melissa Bartholomew, who is one of the victims discovered at Gilgo Beach. Melissa's mother reported to People magazine, quote, "I don't know what to think because Melissa had a lot of calls to Manorville from her phone, and that is where this guy is from." However, others are not as convinced about John Bitroff being the suspect, including John Ray, who was the lawyer for the Gilbert family before Marie's passing. He said that there was nowhere near enough evidence to tie Bitroff to the Long Island serial killer murders, and he said that naming Bitroff, quote, "enables the district attorney's office to present to the public that they have found the killer and he's already in jail, and it makes their job infinitely easier." Bitroff's attorney, Jonathan Manley, also doesn't buy it, and he told the media that, quote, "this trial lasted 2.5 months. There were days of pretrial hearings and applications, and never once in 3 years that this case was pending did he ever say anything like this. I think the statements were made simply to sensationalize this and garner a headline." Shannon Gilbert's murder and the murders of the 10 victims found while searching for her still remain unsolved. So that is it for this week's episode of Unsolved, Unbelievable, and Unjust. I hope you like what you guys heard. Like I said, it was a twisty and turny case. If you have an opinion on who you think is responsible for the Long Island serial killers case or Shannon Gilbert's case, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. You can send me an email at unsolvedunbelievableunjust@gmail.com, or you can reach out to me on Instagram at unsolvedunbelievableunjust. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and I will see you all next week. Also, I apologize if you hear any construction or my dog whining in the background. Sorry!